From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro has tested positive for COVID-19. We learned that news today. So have more than 300,000 Americans just in the first few days of July. In Georgia, the mayor of Atlanta says she's tested positive. We're going to check in there in just a moment.
But first, pressure is mounting on hospitals to keep up with the surge of patients. At least five hospitals in Central Florida ran out of ICU beds this week. And in remote parts of Southern California, hundreds of critically sick patients are being flown from Imperial County near the Mexican border to hospitals hundreds of miles away. Sergio Cardenas is a program director for Reach Air Medical Services in Imperial County, and he joins us now from Brawley, California. Sergio, thanks for making the time. I know you're incredibly busy.
No, thanks for having me.
And just how busy are you now that the two hospitals in your county appear to be reaching capacity?
We've been, before COVID, you know, we used to do about one or two flights a day. Now with the surge, we're doing about three or four daily and sometimes five in a 24-hour period.
Wow. And how sick are the patients you're moving?
You know, they vary. Some of them are, as you would expect, they're very, very sick, requiring intense ventilator management. But, you know, there are some that are stable and require transfers to other facilities simply because our local facilities here don't have the capacity or the capability to take care of them.
Hmm. Tell me who you're transporting. I mean, Imperial County's right there on the border. I'm sure there's a lot of agricultural work going on down there. Who are these patients?
These are everyday people. They're farm workers, like you mentioned, but there's also some healthcare workers. There's American citizens that live down in Mexico and Mexicali. Sometimes they come north to seek healthcare. We do have a lot of binational commerce and trade and traffic that comes across just simply, you know, every day.
Yeah. And in some cases, it looks like you're taking these patients all the way up to Northern California. Why not stay closer to home, say San Diego, Riverside, or Los Angeles, somewhere much closer to Imperial County?
Yeah, well, you know, initially that's the intent. But when facilities that are more local, like San Diego, Riverside, don't have bed capacity either, it's difficult to place those patients there.
And do you know of any cases, you know, people who have died because they haven't been able to get to a hospital in time because there wasn't room?
Not that I know of, no.
Okay. So the idea of transferring patients to different hospitals, it's not new, as you say, especially in areas where there isn't as much hospital capacity. People break a leg or have a heart attack, they got to go. But during COVID-19, that is new. How different is dealing with this disease? What kind of new challenges does it bring you?
Yeah, you know, so the flight crews typically would transfer your typical heart attack, stroke victims to other facilities or trauma patients that require trauma services to other regional facilities, right? But the dynamic that COVID adds to these transports are you are in full PPE, right? We're talking gowns, gloves, masks, N95 masks, goggles, right? Because you have to decontaminate your aircraft on the way or when you get back home. Hmm. So typically a call before, right, to one of the neighboring counties, it would take about three and a half hours to complete. We're talking from the time that you get to receive the call to the time that you're back home. That is now probably been extended to about 4.5 to 5 hours.
Wow.
And that's because these calls do require a little bit more time.
Your crews must be exhausted.
Yes. And to add to that, you're adding summer heat here in Imperial County, which can get upwards of 115 to 120.
Oh, wow. So meanwhile, things are getting worse across the entire Sun Belt, right? I mean, are you concerned that you're going to run out of options because hospitals that you're going to now are going to be filling up?
Well, you know, there are mechanisms in place, right? We have here in Imperial County, we have a field medical station that's been set up probably for a month now, a little bit over that. We do have ground transportation available through one of our partners through Global Medical Response. So there are other options to help decompress. But you're right, this is not, it doesn't show any signs of slowing down.
What needs to be done to make your job easier and to make the job of all the healthcare professionals in these hospitals across Texas, California, Arizona, Florida, to make it easier?
You know, I think having more resources available, right? And, you know, if I could ask for the world, it would be to have facilities that have capacity that are more local. These longer transports, transports to Northern California, for example, or even, you know, outside of the 150 nautical mile range, that those are taxing to the crews. And those are the situations where we become stressed out because they are longer calls and there's a lot of planning and mitigation that goes into place.
Well, I have to say, Sergio Cardenas, thank you for the work that you're doing and that your crews are doing. You're program director for Reach Air Medical Services in Imperial County, California. It's near the Mexican border. You're also a registered nurse. Best of luck to you. We do appreciate what you're doing out there.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, the state of Georgia has confirmed more than 98,000 cases of COVID-19, and one of those cases is the mayor of Atlanta. Let's bring in Stephen Fowler, a political reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
So the Atlanta mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, yesterday said she tested positive for COVID-19, although she says she has no symptoms. Here she is on MSNBC.
This is startling for me because we've been so very careful. But certainly we are not immune. And again, this is just a lesson to everyone that you have to take every single symptom seriously.
Stephen, does she know how she might have contracted it?
Well, Jeremy, you know, it's still the initial phase. She actually, just before going on MSNBC, made the announcement that she had tested positive. Her husband and one of her children also tested positive. The mayor has been following the precautions, washing hands, wearing masks, keeping distance. But she's been a few high-profile places lately. She was at the funeral for Rayshard Brooks 2 weeks ago, who was a black man killed by a white police officer. And Sunday night, she was at a press conference. And so she's not exactly sure, but says that her staff is working with contact tracing to figure out exactly how she contracted the virus. But as you heard her say, you know, it was just stunning to her because she followed all the precautions.
Well, she's reportedly a top contender to be Joe Biden's vice presidential pick. What does this mean for her now? Will she have to lay low and quarantine for a couple of weeks?
Well, that's right. She said she's going to be staying at her home office, but thanks to the internet and everything else, she made appearances on MSNBC. She was on CNN. She was on Good Morning America. So this doesn't necessarily derail her visibility in the national media and the national spotlight, because you can always do a TV hit even from quarantine.
Let's talk about COVID-19 in general in Georgia. The Department of Public Health there has confirmed more than 2,800 deaths due to coronavirus, but preliminary data from the last week show the number of new cases and deaths declining sharply. What is the state of the pandemic in the state right now?
Well, Jeremy, it's good you ask that. The way Georgia reports its coronavirus data is a little bit different. What you see on the Department of Public Health website is based on the day somebody first shows symptoms of COVID-19. So, for example, from Sunday to Monday, about 1,500 new positives were reported, but it was assigned on a graph based on the day somebody first had symptoms. So there's going to be about a week or two lag between what you see on the state's website and the raw cases on the ground. So while it looks like the preliminary numbers are low, 2 weeks from now when things are filled in, you'll see that Georgia's cases keep getting higher.
And is there a sense that the governor, Brian Kemp, is going to actually require people to wear masks statewide? He has so far just been encouraging it, but hasn't required it.
That's right. Governor Brian Kemp has been traveling around the state, encouraging people, imploring them to wear masks and to follow guidelines. He's not indicated that he's going to issue a statewide mask mandate. In fact, under his current executive order and state of emergency, cities and counties can't do anything more or less than what the state asks. So we already have some cities that are trying to test that boundary by enacting their own bans.
I just want to ask you about one more thing. Governor Kemp has called in 1,000 troops from the National Guard under a state of emergency that he declared after a spate of shootings over the weekend, which claimed the lives of 5 people, including an 8-year-old girl. This happened near the site where Rayshard Brooks, as you mentioned, was killed on June the 12th by a white police officer. What more do we know today about the shootings over the weekend? And what's been the reaction to this order from the governor?
Well, the governor sending in the National Guard to protect state buildings like the Capitol and the governor's mansion and other things, so they aren't actually going to protest sites. But it does free up the Georgia State Patrol to make more patrols. There have been some shootings near the site where Brooks was killed, and protesters say that has nothing to do with them. And so they're pretty upset about this increased presence and authorities did on Monday to clear out that site and put up barriers to prevent more violence from happening.
That is Stephen Fowler, political reporter with Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. A lot going on from, as we said there, the governor's emergency order to coronavirus to the positive case for the mayor of Atlanta. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Some Republicans are growing increasingly uncomfortable with President Trump's divisive statements on race, the Confederacy, and police protests. Just yesterday, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham broke with the president for defending the Confederate flag in a tweet, and one prominent black Republican strategist is choosing to leave the party. On July 4th, Shermichael Singleton tweeted that he's been associated with the GOP since middle school when he started a chapter of the Teenage Republican Society. He says leaving the Republican Party was no easy thing, but for him, it was the right thing. Shermichael Singleton joins us now. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And you know, you spoke with NPR back on June 14th and you asked yourself a question. You said, why am I still a Republican? At the time, you still were. How did you finally come to the answer that you're not?
You know, I had thought about it and I've been thinking about this actually for a long time. I've been thinking about this, contemplating this, reflecting on it for probably 2.5 years now. And I finally just sort of got to the point where I realized, sure, President Trump has supported policies that, you know, most even traditional Republicans would have likely attempted to support and pass if a different Republican was in office, such as tax reform, deregulation, strengthening the military. But I had to ask myself, in spite of the policies, the behavior, the character, essentially, does the ends justify the means? And I finally came to the conclusion that they do not. And so I said it has to be bigger than the policies. To be a conservative has to be more than just passing a piece of legislation here or there. There has to be a certain level of temperament associated with it. There has to be a certain way of being, the way one carries him or herself, the way they treat others, the way they view the world. And so that's why I finally determined that that the values that the president has and maintains as an individual just aren't consistent with my values, and they aren't consistent with what I believe conservatism should be or can be.
And what's the reaction, Ben? I mean, I know that sounds like almost a throwaway question, but I think it's relevant because our producer tells me that you had to change your phone number after you tweeted this.
Yeah, I did. I just changed it. I mean, most of my friends sort of knew that I've been thinking about this for a long time. And for the most part, I've been rather supportive. But then I had some folks who were not very happy. The vast majority were supportive, but I had a few folks who weren't very happy. And, you know, that's okay. My response to those folks, as I have spoken with most of them, was, you know, look, I respect your right to support the president. I would hope you respect my right to disagree with the president. The party is just going in a direction that I'm just not comfortable with.
You may have seen this new Gallup poll this week that shows the president's approval rating at 38%. But that it also went up in the past month among Republicans from 85% to 91%. So I hear you. I hear what you're saying. But do you think you're an outlier? Or do you think you're a sign that the president's campaign to divide along the lines of race in America is alienating even his supporters? I mean, how do you read what's going on?
Well, so that's a really good question. So let me speak to the latter part of the question regarding Republican support increasing with the president. That's to be expected with tribalism at the height that it is in our country right now. We're all segmented into these tribal groups. Now, on the flip side, why has his support decreased so precipitously? I believe because people, particularly independents, not folks who are Democrats or consider themselves Democrats, they were automatically against the president. But it's those folks in the middle, that sweet spot that may have crossed over to vote for him in 2016. I think some of those individuals are becoming concerned, and I think they're becoming primarily concerned because they may have said, I voted for him because I wanted something different. I wanted something to be shaken up in Washington or across the country, or perhaps it was a person who was a business owner and they liked deregulation, or a military person, whatever the case may be. And they may ask themselves, are those things worth division? Are those things worth racial tensions? Are those things worth the morale of the country further being brought down by a lack of leadership coming from the top? And well, I think some of those people are saying, no, it's not. So I think that's why you're seeing those two numbers the way they are.
And the president will need those people in November if he wants to stay in the White House. I want you to play out two scenarios for me. The first, if the president wins in November, what happens to the Republican Party?
I think if the president wins in November, he will have permanently shifted the Republican Party into his brand of what Republicanism is.
And if he loses, what happens to the party? Will there be a reckoning like there was supposed to be in 2000?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yes, I think if he loses, I think you're going to this is going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. And I think a lot of the president's supporters will dissipate because a lot of voters who voted for President Trump in 2016 were not traditional Republican voters. They weren't traditional voters, generally speaking. Most of them didn't really vote at all. They only came out for Donald Trump. And so I think if Trump were to lose, I think a lot of those individuals go away, which goes to a point that I want to make. It enables the party to attempt to truly reset itself. But man, I got to tell you, they're going to have to do a lot of persuading of a lot of different groups that the party is certainly going to need going forward. The Republican Party has been talking for decades about demographic changes and demographic outreach. And for the most part, they have been able to survive and exist without really putting in that work. But I finally think the chickens are coming home to roost. So we'll see what happens in the end.
Look, I know this has got to be hard for you. As we said, you've been associated with the party since middle school when you started a Teenage Republican Society chapter. And as you say, you're still a conservative. So where does that leave you for November? I mean, do you want Joe Biden to win?
You know, it leaves me in November hoping that there was an alternative to President Trump. I respect former Vice President Biden. I think he's a decent man. I think he's a man of character. I certainly don't agree with him on all policies. But I will say this, if he were to win, it would give the Republican Party an opportunity to reset. And I think that's a necessary opportunity that the party needs if it is to survive in the long run. On the alternative, if he does not win and President Trump does win, then all of my concerns, all of my fears will really become actualized, as I do not think that there will be a party for me to return to.
So will you vote for Biden?
Answers your question.
Yeah, well, I want to – what do you think? You don't want to say, do you?
I don't want to say.
All right. I'll let you off the hook this time. Sure, Michael Singleton, a political strategist who has left the Republican Party. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, as employees at tech companies join the movement against racial injustice, some are calling attention to the language of the industry itself. The head of Microsoft's GitHub, that's the web's biggest site for software developers, says it will retire the decades-old coding terms master and slave after a group of coders called out the terminology for its racist connotation. Let's bring in Shireen Ghaffari, a reporter for Recode. Hi, Shireen. How are you?
Hi, fine, thanks.
And so let's start with what these terms, master and slave, are referring to in the first place in tech.
Sure. So these terms refer to situations in computer programming when one process or entity controls another. So when something like one hard drive or a database controls another one, and the one that's leading is referred to as master, and the other one is referred to as a slave. So that's what that is.
Where'd that come from? And had it bothered anyone before this moment that we're in?
I think the history of the terms is not quite clear, but it's obvious that there's an association there with slavery in the U.S. for many, and that some companies are trying to use more inclusive language now. Even though this terminology has been used for decades, people are saying that now, in light of the conversations we're having about racial injustice in this country, it's time to renew and use more inclusive language.
Okay, so as you say, people are calling for change. Coder's saying this is definitely not right, doesn't feel right. Tell me more about the efforts to change the phrase and what alternatives are being floated.
So at companies like GitHub, which you mentioned, also at Twitter, there have been changes proposed to replacing these words that have this association with slavery with other words. So instead of slave and master at Twitter, they're going to use leader and follower. I've also heard of people using, instead of whitelist and blacklist, people are also using allow list and deny list. Also at Twitter, they're expanding the changes on inclusive language to not just be about words that have a racial association, but also ones that have gendered association. So instead of things like man hours, they're going to use person hours or engineer hours.
Huh. So, this is interesting. Wired spoke with a few black coders who thought that efforts like this are going a little bit too far. I know one called it a performative activism. Another said that it's not words that's the issue here. It's police brutality that's really the big picture problem across the board in this country. What do you think about that?
Sure. So there's certainly folks who feel that way, and I've heard that sentiment as well. But I do think that there's also a lot of people, including at Twitter, where an engineer who is black was leading efforts on these language changes. His name is Reginald Augustin, according to CNET, which had a good story on this. But I think there's also a big movement of people within these companies who want to see changes to this language and think that this kind of terminology is outdated.
But it's not just the language, right? I mean, it's also the lack of diversity at the upper levels of management across the board in these companies. There are bigger issues to address in tech.
That's right. Tech has a diversity problem. It hasn't made much progress as a whole on hiring more people of color in its upper ranks, as well as women. So I think that it is true that there are bigger issues perhaps in technology than language, but that doesn't mean that language isn't an issue or it isn't something to be debated.
That's Shireen Ghaffari, a reporter at Recode. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Most live music venues around the country have been shut down for almost 4 months because of the pandemic. In Washington, D.C., some venue owners are finding creative ways to adapt their businesses to this new reality, while others are struggling to survive. Michaela Lefrak of member station WAMU reports.
The idea of going to a concert kind of feels like a magical relic of the before times. Sure, we're in phase two of reopening now, but gatherings of more than 50 people are still banned. Most indoor concert halls remain closed, including the Black Cat in D.C. Dante Ferrando's the owner.
I'm getting calls, though. Hey, are you guys open tonight? Like, no, you guys don't understand. We're not open until next year.
The Black Cat's known for sweaty rock shows and dance parties. Ferrando says there's no way for him to reopen in the foreseeable future and make any money. Paying overhead costs like insurance and staffing isn't possible unless he can sell hundreds of tickets, not the 50 he thinks he would sell while enforcing social distancing rules.
The numbers just don't work. They're not there. It's insanely expensive.
Ferrando's one of many venue owners that's lobbying the city and the federal government for more support in the form of property tax rebates or rent relief. Otherwise, he says, they could close. It's not an empty threat. In mid-June, the popular nightlife spot 18th Street Lounge closed after 25 years in the DuPont Circle neighborhood because the owner said he couldn't afford the rent.
That hurts so much to see that. So many people have had incredible experiences there.
Audrey Fix Schaefer is the communications director for IMP, the company that runs some of the area's biggest music venues. She's also the communications director for a new organization called the National Independent Venue Association. They've been lobbying Congress for help since March.
Government support by cash and tax incentives are going to be the only thing that will save us.
even if venues could reopen, they might struggle to find national acts to book. But that could be good for local musicians. Ali Vega is a musician and the talent buyer at DC9, a small bar, restaurant, and venue in DC's Shaw neighborhood. She says bands probably aren't going to be touring nationally until next year.
In the meantime, I think we're going to be really heavily reliant on local music, which is in a way cool because DC has such like a deep well of really talented musicians in all sorts of different genres.
DC9 has also been playing around with ways to make their venue feel safer. One idea is to put up a plexiglass barrier between the stage and the audience. Vega's on the fence about this, but says it'd be better than the status quo.
You know, even playing to like 20 people in a room is still a good feeling. And certainly better than playing to your phone for an Instagram live stream.
But some venues are investing in live streams until they can host crowds. Dante Ferrando is putting on live streamed events from the Black Cat, though it's a far cry from the packed concerts he'd rather be hosting.
I think we're stuck mostly with ideas that involve virtual content coming from the club while we're closed. It's kind of all we're left with.
Meanwhile, a few weeks ago, people gathered in a garden in Alexandria, Virginia, to watch a performance by local classical musicians. The concert was put on by Classical Movements, a local touring company. It was one of three concerts put on that day. Each audience was limited to about 40 people. And instead of squishing down into plush concert hall seats, they stood 6 feet apart. It wasn't what anyone was used to. But for one afternoon at least, the music was back. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela LaFrac.
Long before the pandemic, one of the worst epidemics in the United States was opioid addiction. In 2018, the most recent year we have complete data for, more than 67,000 people died of drug overdoses, and 70% of those overdose deaths were caused by an opioid, either heroin, a prescription painkiller like OxyContin, or a synthetic opioid like fentanyl. The opioid crisis has not gone away. In fact, the pandemic has made it worse. Joining us now is Dr. Nora Volkoff, who is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Dr. Volkoff, welcome. And how has the opioid addiction crisis been affected by the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, it has been affected. Actually, we can surmise quite seriously. We know that from reports of overdoses, this may have increased 30-40%. We know also that from some of the reports from the states that there has been increases on overdose fatalities, that there has been increases in patients relapsing that had already achieved recovery. So we are hearing these distress calls from throughout the country.
And what do you think would be the reason for that? If you're seeing in some cases a 30 to 40% increase in overdoses, why would that be happening now? Is it just people's mental state, or is it inability of those who would help people who are addicted to opioids to actually get to those people because of the pandemic, or what?
There are all of those factors, and indeed it's the multiplicity of factors that are making people addicted to opioids so vulnerable. A very important one is the stress and the uncertainty that we are all living under these conditions, the social isolation through social distancing, but also through the closing of many of the community services that are so important for people that are trying to stay away from drugs or achieve recovery. And so that isolation, that stress, is one of the factors that leads to relapse. It's one of the factors that actually make many of us start to take drugs as a means to temporarily escape that state. So it's a very important contributor. But there are other factors that are playing into it also, including the erosion of treatment programs that in the past were able to provide medications that are so necessary to protect the lives of people that are addicted to opioids. The hospitals, the emergency departments are overcrowded with COVID. So access to those services is now much harder for many of them. The stigma that has permeated addiction also makes it much less likely that people seek out help. The fact that we're very isolated now, if someone is taking opioids and they overdose, the probability that someone sees them and can give them naloxone, which is necessary to reverse the overdoses is much less likely. The lack of jobs is another aspect that makes it even more challenging. If you're trying to achieve recovery, one of the components is that you want to integrate yourself to everyday life. And now it's much harder to get jobs.
So what is the solution to that? Because especially as we start to see these spikes in many parts of the country in terms of COVID cases, you don't really see an end in sight to the pandemic and to all of the things that we have to do as a result of the pandemic. What is the solution for people who are dealing with opioid addiction right now?
First of all, the solution, and we as a society have to provide resources and means to do it. And that is the recognition that we cannot just ignore it, that we have a pandemic that we absolutely, it's urgent that we take care of. But at the same time, we need to address the opioid epidemic because it's there and both of them are colliding. This has resulted in some changes on the way that we're able to treat patients with opioid addiction that had made it now easier to access medications through telemedicine, which in the past was not possible. So if you wanted to get buprenorphine, you had to go physically see a doctor. If you were being treated with methadone, you had to go to a methadone clinic on a daily basis. So now it is possible to take home methadone so that instead of going daily, you can take doses for 1 month. Reimbursement for telemedicine services, which is now much easier than it was before COVID, allows to provide the support because frequently they have comorbid psychiatric disorders that require attention, like depression or anxiety. And without it, they will relapse. There's also multiple applications that have emerged that provide virtual social support system. So you can get a mentor or a coach, or you can go to a group therapy through a virtual mechanism. Of course, not everybody has access to the web or a cell phone. And those are the ones that may actually require additional interventions. To the extent that all of this is very new, we do not have a sense of how effective it is. We hear from patients and family members that it is not as good as going in person. Mm-hmm. But we also see from some of the studies that in some instances that results are actually quite comparable sometimes with some of the interventions that are done face-to-face.
Before the pandemic, was this country starting to get a handle on the opioid crisis at all?
Well, in 2017, we felt for the first time, because there was a decrease for the first time in many years on mortality from overdoses, that we may have bent the curve. And we had seen the curve bend downwards for deaths from prescription opioids. And we have also started to see a decrease in the deaths from heroin. But around 2013-14, we started to see a very precipitous rise on deaths from synthetic opioids like fentanyl. And those have continued to rise. But in 2017, overall, all of these deaths from all of these types of opioids level off. And then, unfortunately, on 2019, the data looks like it's actually going up again. I mean, and that was before COVID. And it seems it may be going up. And this is from preliminary estimates from the CDC, 3-4%. And in 2020, we expect further increases. We had hoped that perhaps because of the closing of the borders, that it would be much harder to get drugs into our country, and that would decrease the number of people dying from these drugs. But that has not been the case, apparently. Again, and overdoses, I don't mean necessarily that they are going to be overdose fatalities, where the numbers that are being traced right now is number of overdoses. Fatalities has been harder. What the numbers are harder to come across. In some of the communities, they are not doing autopsies because of the overwhelming situation with COVID. So we don't know those numbers.
It seems like quite a conundrum, though, for a public health professional to be in a situation where we know that people isolating and staying at home is helpful for COVID. But it also seems like we know that isolating and staying at home is very unhelpful for people who are depressed or dealing with an opioid addiction.
No, indeed. And I think that we have to face the reality that this situation of isolation is particularly hard for people suffering from substance use disorders, also depression or other psychiatric disorders. Withdrawal and isolations actually just in general exacerbates the problem. The question that has always been lingering is to what extent some of those deaths that we describe as overdose deaths have actually been intentional. It is calculated that perhaps 15 to up to 30% of overdose deaths were intentional to a certain degree. I mean, that is another aspect that we're very concerned as you're speaking about social isolation, that of suicide.
Let me just finally ask you, if there is somebody listening to this who is struggling with opioid addiction right now, what would you want them to know?
I would want them to know that there is treatment and that treatment works. I mean, addiction is a very serious disorder and it can jeopardize your life. So seek help, seek treatment.
That is Dr. Nora Volkoff, who is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Dr. Volkoff, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me and for your attention to this matter.
$20 million people could be kicked out of their homes by the end of summer as eviction moratoriums begin to expire in states across the country. New York State passed a bill last week extending renter protections, but even that could be a stopgap for the coming tsunami of evictions that some housing experts are predicting. And it's not just a concern for tenants. Landlords rely on rent to pay their mortgages, and many are worried about what will happen if people can't pay. Ayat Nieves is a real estate agent and a landlord of 5 rental properties in Buffalo, New York. Ayat, welcome.
It's good to be here.
And tenants across the country are in a tough situation because paying the rent is getting harder and harder the longer this pandemic goes on. How are you doing as a landlord? How are you feeling?
Oh, I'm terrified. It's just absolutely terrifying to think that one day you could wake up and your tenant will say, I can't pay, and you might be in a financial hole along with them.
In New York, there is still a moratorium on evictions for anyone who's been affected by COVID-19. What's your situation like? You know, what will you do for tenants who can't pay the rent? What have you done for tenants who can't pay the rent?
For tenants who can't pay the rent, I've given them a small reprieve. If there's anything they can do around their home, such as lawn maintenance, I'll allow them to do it and take a deduction. And I also tell them about the different programs like the ones that Home offers to help them get caught up on their rent.
And what does it mean for you? I mean, if all 5 of your properties, you start seeing people who aren't paying the bills, what will it do for you?
I'd probably have to consider selling some of the properties.
What does that look like? Is there a market for multifamily residential buildings in Buffalo right now as the economy is starting to crater all over the country?
Buffalo, New York is an anomaly. Our real estate market is booming. I've seen houses, rental properties, and owner-occupied properties come on the market, sell it within a day or two. I recently put in an offer on 2 side-by-side doubles on the city of Buffalo's east side. These houses needed everything from the roof to the plumbing to the heating. They came on at $45,000. We bid $10,000 over on each, and we still lost a bid to another cash buyer. So the market's doing great. A lot of people from New York are moving to Buffalo and pumping the values up.
So even landlords are willing to take on more risk at this time when there's the potential for people not to pay their rent. People, you know, landlords are willing to invest money in new apartments?
Some landlords are, yes.
Okay, so if you're investing in these properties, you have to come up with a calculation. What are you going to do if a tenant comes to you and says they can't pay the bills? How does that work?
Well, the first, you have to consider the human cost. I mean, I like most of my tenants. They're great people, and I've known many of them up to, 7 and 8 years. So I always do my best to work with the tenants. When COVID struck, I created a quick little statement saying if there are any issues with rent and repairs, let me know ahead of time. I prefer to be proactive instead of reactive. Hmm. So I always engage people to have a conversation. And should somebody say, I need this help, I'll go out and I'll find an agency or a resource that they could use to potentially get caught up.
And many landlords are good and decent people too, but there's going to be a lot of people who say, look, I don't feel bad at all for property owners who aren't getting rent checks right now. That was the risk that you assumed when you decided to become a landlord, and here we are in a pandemic. What do you say to that?
I hear that a lot.
You do.
And those same people will also tell you that the tenants have a right to housing and will rebuttal that they have a right to pay for it. And now more than ever, people are spending more time at home, so they should pay for it. It's a risk, but landlords bear risk, tenants bear risk. And if tenants don't pay, unfortunately, some will be evicted.
Some governments, though, have been extending the moratoriums on evictions. In other states, they've lapsed and evictions are starting to back up in some courts now. What's your position on eviction moratoriums? Should they be extended longer?
No. I believe the government should subsidize those people who fell between the cracks and help them get caught up on rent. But you cannot ask landlords to take the brunt of the burden when some banks aren't even working with us.
And we've got these numbers. 20 million people could face eviction by the end of the summer. That's a tremendous amount of people, of human beings, who may not have a place to live. What do you think that could mean, generally speaking, for the business that you're in? Like, after this crisis is over, this pandemic is over, what will renting and home ownership even look like anymore?
It will look very bad. I mean, I think of Buffalo, New York, where we've been rebounding over the last decade, and I do not want to go back to walking down the street full of vacant homes and trash littering everywhere and then homeless people, you know, on the sidewalk or in the alleyways. It's just not a good look, and it's bad for our communities.
What can be done about it?
The government has a role to play in stabilizing people and their housing situations. They should get ahead of the crisis and provide smaller landlords and smaller tenants with the financial help that they need to not only meet rent demands for today, but to meet the rent demands of the future and live in safe, affordable housing.
That's Ayat Nieves, a real estate agent and property owner, landlord in Buffalo, New York. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.